If you want to learn about the music industry and you don't know where to go, tune in to WP88.7 Brave New Radio. We got managers, producers, record labels, concert promoters galore. Every Wednesday at 8 p.m.
You're listening
to Music Biz 101 and more.
We are Music Biz 101 and more, your free advice radio show and podcast. Find us every Wednesday at Brave New Radio, 88.7 FM on the campus of William Patterson University in scenic Wayne, New Jersey, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher Radio, also as a podcast. I'm your co-host, Professor David Kirk Philp, with your other co-host, Dr. Esteban.
Yep.
Dr. Esteban, yep.
Yep.
We are alive, and we are pre-recording what you're listening to from Nashville, Tennessee, at the Music Biz 2016 convention. Tremendous.
How's the weather out there today?
The weather, we have no idea, because we're in the bowels of the
convention center.
But we should give thanks to Music Biz Association for actually letting us do this.
Correct.
At no charge. So we're down here. We're recording many interviews. We have an interview with our good friend John Butler from Curb Records
today.
Thank you. John Butler.
Thank you for having me.
Please don't interrupt.
All right, great.
It's going to be held by Dr. Charles Potenza, who's getting his MBA in music management from William Patterson University.
And why did you say doctor?
Doctor, because Charles actually is it a doctorate? He hides behind his doctorate of pharmacology.
Yeah.
Doctor of pharmacy. Yeah. It's not as cool.
And he got a free ride with us, didn't he? Because he's our. He's a direct link
to all of our pharmacy. Charles hooks us up.
I wish I was on for.
is that legal now? Medical marijuana in New Jersey?
Yeah.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Charles knows.
Yeah.
Charles spent a lot of time working at the legality.
We're only kidding, Kathy.
I know. But by the way, we should thank. Sure. So we want to thank Jim Donio, president of the Music Biz Association, and all those who have been helping us and giving us a space here in the Nashville Convention Center for William Patterson University students like Dr. Charles Potenza to connect and interview with some great guests. We want to thank MIA, the Music and Entertainment Industry Education Association, for their grant, which helped pay for people like Charles to get here. We want to thank the folks at Van Dyne, Bruno, Inc. and White Hat Management, our good buddy Aaron Van Dyne, who's the Van Dyne and Van Dyne Bruno. They sponsored some of this to help
Bruno.
I've never met the Bruno.
We're never going to get to John Butler.
We're never going to get to the Butler and John Butler. With artists like Charlie Puth, Dave Matthews, Sharon Jones, the Dap Kings, and Kiss, there's only one place to go for your band's business management. Go to vb-cpa.com when you are ready, meaning every band isn't ready for management, but when they are ready for their business management, these are the people to go to, Dr.
Correct.
Marconi. I am correct, so I am not wrong. We also want to give thanks to Christine Vey, a wealth manager and the president of Vay Wealth Management. Christine has helped many of our professionals at William Patterson to manage their investments and plan out their retirement. If you're looking for some guidance on how to plan for your retirement, or you have questions on anything from investments and portfolio management to insurance and retirement planning, give Christine a call at John. Please repeat after me.
732-455-1510.
You can also email her, Christine at VayWealth.com, for advisement. And now, with much ado, we would like to open the phones. We're taking calls. We are not opening the phones. But Charles, first time, long time, Charles, we would like you to now give, if you have your brief bio on our friend John Lennon Butler. Are you looking? Do you have a little bio?
Yeah.
I have a short there we
bio.
Go. And then we're going to do the bio, and then Charles is going to start asking questions, and Marconi and I will butt in at all times.
Awesome.
You may go. Go!
Yes, we have John Butler with us currently. He's working at Curb Records as VP of promotion.
That's right. Are you nervous, Doctor?
Yeah.
You're the one with the. You're two doctors. Neither of one are John or me. So.
He is an alumni of William Patterson University.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And the music business program.
And the music business program.
Graduated with me.
That's right.
Yes.
We graduated together. Class of 1990.
Who else was in that class? Michael Toll is in that class.
An airline
was
pilot.
Rob Fusari in that class?
Sort of.
Yeah, he never graduated.
He never graduated.
Until in the 2000s.
Okay, gotcha.
He came back.
Gotcha.
That's Grammy winner Rob Fusari.
That's right. So and Chris Roslin is also in that class, yes, I believe. Yes, as well.
And Dave Radkowski.
That's right.
Formerly of MCA Records. Chris, please, Charles.
Chris is still in the business, yes, too. Yeah. President of Yale. No, it's a PR firm that's sort of left music. Mm-hmm. But it was heavy music when he was in it.
Right.
When he first joined, Paul McCartney was one of their clients and so on.
Oh, that's right. Dr. Potenza, well, please take over.
So
take it back.
He first got his start doing college radio promotion for TVT Records.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah,
and then correct. In that case, you worked with the upcoming group Nine Inch Nails.
At that point in time, yes.
Which is just technically Trent Reznor, right? Isn't it?
At that point in time, it was the band.
Okay.
Trent was the main guy, but he had other folks that were in and out
with
of that band.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have Little John then, right?
No, he wasn't even way there. Before then. TVT had kind of started as a project that Steve Gottlieb, the owner, to put out television theme song records, which is why it was called TVT Records. And he had a tremendous amount of success about 4 or 5 years before I got there, and became this scrappy little independent and started signing young rock bands like the Canals, who were there on that label, the Jack Rubies. He put out a record by an artist from Australia named Shauna Lang. Did a lot of stuff overseas, and was always a pretty eclectic record label even at that point.
Wow. And even before that, you had started with an internship at like Z100, was it?
Yeah, because I worked at WPSC. So
full circle.
It really kind of is.
It wasn't called Brave New Radio back then.
No, it wasn't. Just... It was barely called anything. It was called Laser Hits 89 PSC.
Right. Oh, you were there when they were trying to be like a CHR station.
Yes.
Did it go off campus? It was it was FM?
Yeah, it did. I don't remember the wattage. It probably got to Pompton and that, and a little bit higher.
Got to the Ringwood tower itself, and that was it.
and I believe John Kiernan was the overseer of that. And the idea, and one of the reasons why I was actually able to get a internship at Z100 there in New York was because the station at the William Patterson was a contemporary hit radio format. Was a top 40 radio station. So it was kind of grooming people to be in a situation where you can go right into a working radio environment as opposed to a college freeform format, which isn't necessarily reflected in commercial radio.
And actually our former producer,
Philip Gorachowski,
Z100.
Interned with Elvis Duran.
That's right.
Actually, it was Elvis Duran, technically not Z100.
Right, okay.
But I know, but that, he would always say that to me, right. And I would say exactly what you said, Rob.
You notice that there are, Dr. Charles, do you notice that there's these kind of loops here?
Yeah.
It's cool. Cyclical.
It is cyclical.
Yeah, how did you like it there?
Z100 was a well-run and very powerful radio station, and there was a lot of talented folks that are still in the record business and still in the music business. Kid Kelly was the night DJ, and he's a big wig at Sirius XM, runs their Sirius Hits 1 channel and a number of other channels. And I mean, it really can go down the line. Scott Rubin is a very well-known producer and guy in the business, and he was there at the time.
Scott Shannon, right? Wasn't he doing the morning?
Scott was not there at that point. He had actually left to PLJ.
Oh, he'd already left.
Yeah, it was Ross and Britton in the morning at that point in time. Ross and Wilson. But there were really great music people, and it was a great environment because I got to see people that worked in the record business come in a lot. So all the local record executives came by. It was nearby, and if you had a pop record, you were going to Z100, you were taking a weekly meeting. So one of the responsibilities I had there was kind of like being there when they had the cattle call. It was on, I think it was Thursday mornings, where everybody would just hang out in the lobby waiting to go see either Frankie Blue or Adam Goodman and or Steve Kingston, who was the program director at the time.
So like the program director, they just pick, like how do they kind of pick the rotation? Is it just based on like sales? That's not really it, right?
Well, you know, I mean, back then, those all of the things that we utilize now in promotion were effective tools back then. That in itself hasn't really changed much. There's right. still a tool information to close or sale sort of transactional thing that goes on, but it's all done without, you know, anything changing hands. So it's still a suggested sort of like, hey, you need to play this and here's why. So it's very soft sales, but it's pretty hard. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. It's the best way to describe it. But those things were still as valuable. And Z100 did not take chances. It was a very conservative radio station. But when you were there, you didn't really know that. I wasn't aware of like how many artists were signed, how many things were waiting to get on Z100 or waiting to get on Top 40 Radio that were still in development. So we were dealing with, you know, the most popular songs in the United States.
Yeah.
And that's true of any primary market radio station.
I'd say so, yeah. But they have a wealth of data now, and so do record companies, as opposed to where it was really, it still is a relational business in that sense, but what's changed is that there is just so much data and so much data available, and one of my primary jobs is to kind of filter through what's important to each particular market and each particular person. And it may, I mean, I've always, you know, I'm happy with my relationships and it took a long time to develop those, but, you know, they're not going to play something that's not working. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot more data a lot sooner that will tell us about whether or not there's a song or an artist that winds up being hit worthy for a particular station.
There used to be an old, I guess it was a, I don't know if it was folklore or not, but that these guys in primary markets, when they were responsible for their stations, they weren't just consultants and so on, they would like be reading R&R or Monday Morning Quarterback or something, and Friday Morning Quarterback and so on. Is that football? And there would be maybe like this little station 20 miles outside of St. Louis, and they'd be watching that guy because when he played something, and then they would sort of, because they always wanted to be first in the market with the record, you know. I mean, was that folklore, or were these guys, you know, had these little secrets like?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of feeding of that, and guys that they'd come up with. I don't know if it happens all that much. I mean, I guess it does. The people that are programming radio, or have always programmed, even when I was starting out, moved from small markets to larger markets. It was very rare, and I actually thought that I wanted to be in radio. And so to start at Z100 was like a verboten. It was like, it wasn't going to happen. Somebody had to die, you know, or, I mean, it was the top, right? And I guess I just didn't either have a mentor or anybody that I really had these deep dive conversations with about, you know, how do you do that? But Kid Kelly, for instance, went at nights at Z100, didn't program there. He went to Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania to program. And that's really how he got his programming chops. And there are probably other examples of that, but one that really stands to my mind is that here's the night jock on the biggest station in the world, in America, and he is going to go program in market, you know, 130 to kind of get his chops. So there was always the sense of you remembered where you came from. You were there for 2 or 3 years. You moved around and bounced around. And during that, maybe you were a little bit more flexible with music, or, you know, or the certainly the industry sort of looked at you to be a little bit more flexible with music, and so you could really you developed a network of people that eventually moved on to other radio stations, and there's a trust level of a lot of programmers with people that they worked with, where they may just informally get together with one another. So what do you think of this? Am I really getting shafted on this record, or is this really happening? That's a close, I mean, to be part of that cabal, which is really what it is, it's like that's how Network started, you know, that whole group of, you know, independents as well as radio stations that kind of really followed one another.
Yeah.
And it happens in chains of radio stations now. iHeart Radio have their own regional program managers that really kind of, they get together and they really talk about music and they decide pretty across the board what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Even though there's individual program directors, there is a national radio programming element to this. It's actually what they're seeing now is that they're starting to give more decision-making ability and power to local programmers in certain markets because they've seen the value of local radio and that each market definitely has their own music flavor. Mm-hmm. But during after consolidation, and I'm jumping around a lot, but this is part of my you know, the gig that I'm dealing with right now is like they're starting to loosen up a little bit of this idea that there is one national format and you can program it out of one person for the entire nation, and that's going to work. And if anything, streaming and all the other ways that we consume music are definitely showing that, you know, it's much more Wild West and much more, you know, varied. Even though it doesn't appear on paper to be like that. That stations, if you go to a particular market, you know, Nashville is different than New York, and it will always be different than New York. And LA is a different vibe, and Miami is a different vibe. Putting a cookie cutter format that plays the same thing in each of those markets, you're going to get different results.
And you can tell that from, you mentioned data earlier. Like, you guys use Shazam? We had Joe Riccatelli on from RCA back in October, and he was talking about how they use Shazam and talking about the different data points that they use. And I would think that Shazam, for example, would be able to, you know, if you see people in Nashville Shazamming a pop track, it might be completely different from Florida or Oklahoma.
So. Yeah, and up until a certain point. And then because Shazam's great because radio, it's kind of like, It's a really effective way for radio to kind of see what's coming back to them in a direct consumer way, as opposed to just online research or traditional, you know, research. So, you know, if something is Shazamming in a market, it must be getting airplay. I mean, it's yes, you can Shazam when you're in a store. I find that I'm Shazamming in a store or just randomly.
I was in the bathroom earlier.
And you Shazammed, that must have been weird for somebody to see you at the stall and go, Shazam!
It was a closed door session. So, but I've had that happen where I've gone into a bathroom in a, whether it's a rest stop or a restaurant, and I didn't have my phone with me, and that's when that song would come on. And I don't have Shazam. I don't have my phone with me to Shazam it. So, and I say something that rhymes with Shazam it because I don't have my cellular telephone on. Charles, please continue.
Can I hit one point on Shazam real quick?
Sure.
Shazam, I mean, it's kind of inside, but I think people would appreciate it. Shazam really is just really reflective of what's already playing at radio. And it also shows that radio's listenership has, even though that some observers really talk about that radio has less influence on new music discovery, is Shazam's the perfect prognosticator to tell everybody that it isn't, that they are the first place, because Shazam is an active person's app. If you're using Shazam, you're into music. There's absolutely no reason why you wouldn't be. So if you're discovering, and if you see and you go and take a look at the markets where things are Shazamming, they tend to do reflect what's getting exposed in that market through traditional media. There are some instances where that's not the case, but for the most part, it really resembles what the most popular stuff is.
Now,
I'm always surprised to see like Taylor Swift on the top of certain Shazams in markets, because I'm like, everybody must know this song already. They have to Shazam it for.
I think the exact same thing. You look at their charts, they're very reflective of Billboard's.
But I think it also talks about like one of the marketer's dilemmas is that even an artist like Taylor Swift doesn't necessarily always occupy the amount of brain space that we tend to give it. And that music's music, and people are not thinking and necessarily and frothing over the idea of a new Taylor Swift record, and they're going to know it immediately. That it is going to wind up having a discovery phase, and that's really reflective in Shazam.
But what you brought up a second ago was the fact that Shazam is basically a reactive measure.
Yes.
It's already on the radio. It's already out. It's not helping get somebody onto the radio.
Well, it is. I think maybe Joe and other promotion people that you've talked to may see that it's a valuable tool when you want to convince another market.
Okay.
It goes back to that relational thing where a PD might know that guy and really respect his radio station. Mm-hmm. And, you see it's Shazamming in Houston. And everybody knows the guy in Houston is a wunderkind and he's playing great records. And so it becomes another one of these tools that were evident. And when I was at Z100,
and that's what I was getting at too. It's a different, so he doesn't have to follow this little guy in St. Louis anymore.
Right.
It's really the basic Shazamming and finding out what that guy is playing, but he had to read it in Friday Morning Quarterback or whatever.
Our biggest thing from a promotion standpoint is that I want predictive elements. Reactive elements are great and they're useful as a tool. To me, it's about being able to go to A&R or in our building and be able to kind of have some predictive elements. And that also seems to kind of like say, well, then you can kind of eliminate the idea of needing somebody to do promotion. Mm-hmm. If you kind of know something's a hit already before you ever go out to market with it because you have all this research, why do you just take the data and go to radio? Mm-hmm. But that's where it's a combination of the art of the relationship, the art of the data, and the art of the promotion skill. And all of those things are now important. Whereas I think when I first started out, and certainly people that were there before me, it was so relational. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it echoes in sales too, with the advent of SoundScan and all these other techniques to kind of find out what's really happening in the market. Because all that stuff used to be on paper and, I need to hit this number here, can you call it in? I don't really know how much Twisted Sister sold in 1984.
No.
I mean, they sold a lot, but how much did they really sell? No deference to Atlantic or anything like that.
I was with PolyGram in my very early days, we would call Fridays was Friday mornings. You would call some retailers that they told you to call, and you would say, "Hey, here are our singles that we want you." If a radio station were to call you and say, "What's selling?" We want you to say John Mellencamp's this Bon Jovi's this is selling, and in return, I'll give you some CDs. Kind of what it was. So it was not based on anything necessarily real. It was based upon, can I convince you to actually say that? And who knows if the guy who I talked to would actually say it?
Right, and I'm sure there's sort of stories about how SoundScan got started or VDS got started. That's probably something else. What else, Dr.
Satenza?
I have a question similar. Say you signed a small band, they have a good song. How would you promote it? That's something I wonder about. An upcoming band, how do they get a song to
on the radio?
Yeah, or how do they even get it on the radio?
Unsigned
band or what?
Well, I don't know. I guess we could say unsigned. Do unsigned bands even get on the radio?
Some do. There's some markets and some radio stations really have the foresight to understand that they have an active and vibrant music community that's basically that, and they want to own that. And from a branding standpoint, if you're a radio station and you want to be Nashville, it's probably a good idea for you to have a Celebrate Nashville sort of show. Somewhere in, it could be any market in America where there's musicians putting out great music, and they either probably put a show that airs sometime on the weekend or in some sort of throwaway audience time to maybe expose those.
And then maybe if they rise to the top, then it'll get
moved. It can. I rarely see that. It used to happen a lot more, I think. Yeah. There's always been battle of the bands, unsigned band contests that stations and record companies have even done in the past, and different ways to discover and nurture talent that way. But from an artist that's signed, radio has become kind of the last place that we as an industry, I am speaking for everybody, but for a number of labels, we want to be able to know that when we go to radio that there's a market base for something, that that artist has toured, that artist is familiar enough that people, when they hear it on the radio, it could be the first time that they're hearing it, but it could be that it's that particular artist has got a fan base that's going to talk back to them, that's going to react, that's going to be able to tell them, hey, this is an artist that we want to be supportive of and it's going to be around for the long haul. Somebody, a great promotion person was talking to me recently about how with new artists or artists at radio, there's a believability level. If my airspace and airtime is this valuable, what makes me want to believe in giving you that spot?
That's airspace.
Are you going to be around? Are you going to have, are you going to create a fan base? And, you know, so that risk for them of playing a song that's unfamiliar, where somebody's going to tune out and not listen to the radio station because they don't know who it is and they don't like it. Mm. No, don't know who it is a tune out now. It might be the greatest song in the world, but they have no idea who it is or they've never heard it before. That could be like, that's not my radio station. I want to hear my favorite songs. Mm. So the branding of most radio stations, we play the hits. So how do the hits work, right? How do the hits work? And there's so many ways now before an artist that's signed get to radio that we can determine or at least have a good enough excuse idea, or an idea that, hey, this artist has value in the marketplace, as opposed to, yeah, we don't know, but you're going to give us that valuable airtime. And I mean, I'm speaking like a programmer right now. Mm-hmm. You know, this is kind of their value is like, that's a spot, you know, 3 minutes and 30 seconds of my airtime. You know, give me your best shot. That's why, you know, peers of mine and other people, you know, are great at, hopefully great at what they do, and they develop new artists. That's a very difficult thing to do.
So you're handed from A&R a non-radio friendly group, new band. So what do you do?
Yeah, that's where my job has changed quite a bit.
Uh-huh.
Because with the advent of streaming and the advent of smaller genre-based formats like AAA or Americana or even just Rhythmic Top 40,
right.
There are more places than ever to go get music exposed. It's just a matter of, does everybody have patience for what it takes to really see the results of that? Because once you start getting to places where there might be valuable for somebody that there might be value for an artist that may not necessarily be radio friendly, but it's kind of like, well, how do you can't necessarily use radio as the first entry into doing that.
Right.
They have to tour.
Yeah.
Or hopefully they'll get something later that might be radio friendly.
Right.
But for the most part, our A&R department is not giving radio something that's not radio friendly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It might not be as competitive as maybe other songs are, but that's all ebb and flow in the landscape and what a programmer gets on their desk every day.
Yeah,
that's the one thing I think a lot about is like, not only do they get CDs still, but they get files delivered to them, they get, you know, a formalized way of music servicing that's digital, and they can just hit delete or not. Once you start to get music into the box of that computer and you can hit delete, it makes it so much harder. But we all as an industry have kind of figured out that that's much cheaper in order to deliver music to instead of producing CDs and producing nice shiny packages. But I'm telling you, we're gonna see a huge shift back to shiny things and amazing things, because the costs have come down to make really good presentations on why it's worth it to go market an artist to you or to your radio station.
And do you still use independent promo guys?
Yeah, they're still independent promo. It's not, it's retainer based for the most part, where it's a certain amount of time for a certain amount of money.
Right.
Like they're extensions of your own staff.
Mm-hmm.
And there are guys that are influential in every format still. And the folks that were there a while back are still working it, because radio guys are still there.
Yeah,
it's still a very insular sort of group of people that have been there and doing it for a long time, and they're successful.
Yeah.
Well, we think the show has been very successful. We have to stop now. It's time to put the brakes on Dr. Potenza.
And Dr. Potenza got down like to two questions.
Yeah.
So, that's one of the good interviews, though, when the guest speaks more than the somebody like Marconi talks.
Yeah.
That's good, which is, happens quite a bit. So
does Dr. Steve talk a lot on the
Dr.
show?
Dr. Steve, sometimes he won't stop talking, and yeah, it's hard for the guests and me to
You ever
really...
see anybody talk with Jim Carrey or not? When Jim Carrey's on? No, you haven't.
All right, so we would
become a straight man in my older age and enjoying it.
I was never the straight man. Really?
You were I always had to give the energy.
I love this. We're discovering something. And how many Marco's. Shows have you done? And we're just learning this right now.
That's fine. So we need to stop this because I'm upset with you, John, for
Very
some reason. It's been held back deep inside my soul for many years. I'll speak with somebody about this, maybe another doctor.
Well, I think we should also have John on during the year for the full hour.
Yeah, we'll have you call in.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Call in and continue this because I think this is really a big piece that even you're not getting in this building for these 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, because everybody's so much into data and metadata and so on and apps and so on, but there is still radio, and everybody will say terrestrial radio is the way to get a hit if you're going to be a radio hit, obviously.
Right. And I think this podcast is going to be a big hit because of the name John Butler. John Butler, giving us hits, bringing the hits.
That was a great transition.
You
have found your calling back to radio. This is really incredible.
The JB. We want to thank the CP, Charles Potenza, Dr. Charles Potenza, for making this happen. You brought John in. Thank you so much. We want to thank Dr. Esteban Marconi.
Well, thank you very much. We want to thank my co-host.
Who is I? Professor David Kirk Phil. And instead of saying hello at the end, we always say adios!